right, ladies, hook, line, and sinker. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to a very rainy edition of Torah Studies. This is Atlanta Live in Atlanta, Georgia. This is Wednesday night, and we are faced with another rainy day here. I feel like we need to arrange where the rain that's extra here, or I don't know if it's extra, but some rain here needs to go somewhere else, like in California. Right, and rain is a blessing, and we ask that all of our blessings should come in such abundance, and that all the blessings should be shared. So let's begin. Today I'm entitling the class different than what you have in front of you, and if you don't have a copy in front of you, let me know, because I have copies right here. You're all set? Okay, pass a few down. Sandrine and Ray, sure. You know, I asked my kids, what's the magic word? They're like, now. Joking, never happened, but it sounded like a good line. Okay, so let's begin. The class, the way I want to title it, is called While You Were Sleeping. While You Were Sleeping. So what happened while you were sleeping, you'll find out tonight. The story begins with a man. I told my kids this today in the car. There was a man named Jake, and he was traveling, and along the road he got tired. So he decided to sleep on the road, but he didn't have any pillows with him. So he used rocks for pillows. And then he had a dream. And in the dream there was a ladder. And the bottom of the ladder was on the ground. And the top stretched all the way to the sky. And on the ladder he saw angels going up and going down. And at that point, my son Ellie, who's 4, he said, I know that story. That's from the Parsha. And I said, you are correct, my friend. Yaakov is the hero of our story. Yaakov has to run away from home because at the end of last week's Torah portion, he may have taken some blessings that were intended, at least on some level, for his brother. And thus, his brother is not too happy about this and wants to exact some revenge. And so Yaakov runs away. He also needs to get married, and he can't marry anyone from Canaan, because Canaan, in the original tradition, the Canaanites are cursed. They're cursed since their ancestor, Chum, had harmed Noah, his father. Anyway, that's a long story, which we're not going to get into. The point is, the bottom line is, that Isaac and Rebecca, Yitzchak and Rivka tell Yaakov, it's time to get married, and you need to go elsewhere. Plus, he knew, again, that his brother was not happy with him, so he decides to get out of town. And again, like I said, in the children's version of it, he's tired, he lies down, he goes to sleep, and he sees angels climbing up and down a ladder. By the way, I was in New York on Sunday, some of you may know this, and I was at my nephew's bar mitzvah. My nephew's name is Yaakov. Yes, that's his name. And I emceed the bar mitzvah celebration. It was quite the party. And so I opened with this Dvar Torah. I'll share it with you quickly, although it's not the main focus of our class, but I figure I'll share it with you. I asked the question, why is it that the angels, right, there was a ladder, and the angels were going up and down the ladder. Why do angels need a ladder to get to heaven? If angels are spiritual, what's the ladder? And if you want to depict angels, what does every angel ever drawn have?
Wings.
Wings. If you have wings, do you need a ladder?
And you have to have feet to have a ladder. Their feet
are staying
together.
Were you hopping up the ladder? That's not even safe.
It was just a dream.
So some say, you can't ask a question on a dream. It's like, what? You're going to ask a question on a dream? Who does that? I do that. No, anyway, but there's a beautiful insight that I shared, and that is sometimes the message is not really about angels, it's really about us. Sometimes you look up to heaven and you say, how am I going to get all the way up there? Or you look up to heaven. You think about goals that you might have. But how do I attain that? It's too big, it's too lofty, it's too high. Right? It's too grand. So even the angels, one step at a time. One step, one rung after the other. That's how we reach the greatest heights, slowly, step by step. You try to jump, it's not going to happen. You try to fly, good luck with that. But step by step, we can get things done.
Well, then why were the angels coming down?
I'm glad that no one asked me at the bar mitzvah that, because that would have totally stopped this situation.
I wasn't in life.
You, well, and it's not because of that. It was just more logistically. It was mostly Brooklynites and immediate family. Okay, so let us jump into our piece of the story. So, Mike, I'd like to ask you to read from the beginning of the Torah portion. Torah portion this week, I should have mentioned at the beginning, the name of the portion is Vayetze. You can find it in the Gutnick edition, which we have in front of us on page 181 in the English. So, Mike, please begin.
Yaakov left Beersheba and went towards Haran. He came across the place, that is, Mount Moriah, and spent the night there because the sun had set suddenly. He took some of the stones of the place and placed them around his head for protection from wild animals, and he lay down to sleep in that place. He dreamt, and look, a ladder was wedged in the ground, and its top reached to heaven. And look, angels of God were going up and down on it.
Okay, please continue.
Suddenly God was standing over him, and he said, I am God, God of Abraham your father, and the God of Yitzhak. I will give to you and to your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be as widespread as the dust of the earth, and you will be strong to the west, to the east, to the north, and to the south. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you and your descendants. Look, I am with you, and I will guard you wherever you go, from Esav and Laban. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not abandon you until I have carried out what I have spoken to Abraham, a promise that was intended for you and not Esau.
All right, one more verse, top of 185.
Yaakov woke up from his sleep and he said, God is truly in this place, and I didn't realize, otherwise I wouldn't have slept here.
Okay, so there you go. So that's the end of the opening few lines of our Torah portion. So how would you characterize God's message to Yaakov, to Jacob, in the dream? What is God telling him, in short?
This land is your
land. This land is your land. There you go, right? So this land is your land.
My land. Yes.
God is promising the land to whom?
Jews.
To the Jewish people, to Yaakov and his descendants. Okay, beautiful. Does this make sense? Is this okay? Are we happy with this? Does this make sense? Because it doesn't make sense to me. Tell me why it doesn't make sense. Do we need... Okay, here, I'm going to ask the question, and hear me out. Do we need, at this juncture, do we need at this point in time, a promise from God to Jacob that this land is going to be given to his descendants? Why yes, why no?
Well, he's already made it come.
Oh, what do you have? Promised it already.
Well, said and done.
Said and done. Signed, sealed, delivered.
But he's leaving.
He's leaving.
He's leaving.
Because I'm leaving.
Right, and so God wants to make sure that he's going to want to come back.
Interesting. I like that. We're going to go in a different direction, but I love that. Yeah.
It's also encouragement for him.
You'll get back here.
Yeah, and that God's going to be with him, and you know it's not going to be an issue with Esau. So. It's that promise to him to keep going.
I got it. I like it. It wasn't his birthright. You're saying because he wasn't the oldest. But he got it. He got it for a bunch of beans. It's legitimate. Okay, good.
And God is telling him it wasn't meant for your brother. It was meant for you.
Right. It's not Esau's, it's yours. Okay, good. We are, first of all, I need to say, I love all these answers, and I believe all of them are true. We're going to still ask the question, which I haven't formally asked. I alluded to it. We're going to formally ask the question, bolster the question, and by the end of the class, you'll see how there's another angle that we're going to take to approach this, which is a more maybe mystical, maybe psychological, maybe whatever. You'll see the approach. Let's establish the basis of the question that we are trying to formulate right now. Let's look at text number 2. Sarah, please read text 2 in the Torah Studies texts. This is page 111 in your student books or student handouts. Page 111, text number 2. Oh, I should tell you, this is from chapter 13 of the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis. Here's God's promise to Abraham regarding the land of Israel.
look on it?
The one and only.
Said to Abram after Lot had parted from him, please raise your eyes and see from the place where you are, northward and southward, eastward and westward. For all the land that you see, I will give to you and to your seed to eternity. And I will make your seed like the dust of the earth, so that if a man will be able to count the dust of the earth, so will your seed be counted. Rise, walk in the land to its length and to its breadth, for I will be with you.
So here we have a clear promise. God is promising to Abraham, to Avram. God is saying that I look around. This land I am giving to you and to your seed to eternity. And if we say that Isaac is the inheritor of Abraham and Jacob is the inheritor of Isaac, then it would follow that God's promise to Abraham will be fulfilled through whom and in whom? Jacob, Yaakov. So in other words, the question that we're formulating, and again, I like the answers and the responses that we discussed, but nonetheless, the question in its original format is, why the need, in this case, in this instance, why the need for God to promise to Jacob, to Yaakov, I will give you this land, if we already have this promise, it's already been discussed. In fact, it's not only once, it's already happened a few times, text number 3. And please read this one, page 112.
On that day, God formed the covenant with Abram, saying, to your seed I have given this land from the river of Egypt until the great river, the Euphrates River.
This is chapter 15, two chapters later. Again, God promises Avram, God says to Abraham, I have given. Look at that. To your seed I have given. It's already done. So again, why the need to repeat it to Jacob? Take a look at text number 4, and this is the Midrash that just that explains what I just pointed out. Dan, please read this one, page 112. So if God has already given the land, if it's already transferred, if it's already given, then why the need to promise it now? Like, oh, it's going to happen to Jacob. It's already happened. What's going on here? It feels like we're going back in time.
He's nervous about his brother, you know, that he didn't.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. So God is reassuring him it's still going to happen. Okay, I hear that. Again, we're going to go in a bit of a different direction. You'll see that we'll see the need for both a promise to Abraham and a promise to Jacob. But if you look, let's point out another interesting tidbit. If you look at text number 2, if you look back at text number 2, 1, 2, 3, the fourth and last paragraph of that text, what does it say? I'll read it again. Rise, walk in the land to its length and to its breadth, for I will give it to you. God is telling Abraham, walk around the land, because this land I am giving to you, or I will give to you. What's the purpose of the walking around the land? What is that, like test driving a car? You kick the tires a little bit. You're walking around. Like, what's, huh? Kick the tires. God's, Abraham's like, you know what? I walked it. You got anything else? No, but what's the purpose of walking? What do you have?
I thought it establishes ownership.
Oh, look at this guy. He's a walking Ramban. Nachmanides says this. Good. Huh? Check this out. Look at this. Before we get there, take a look at text 5. Ray, please read text 5, 113. Let me give a background quickly. Targum Yonatan, which is text 5, which is where text 5 comes from. Targum Yonatan is an Aramaic translation of scripture, authored by Yonatan ben Uziel. And it's a very authoritative, translation. Again, it's in Aramaic, which was, you know, in a certain time in Jewish history, a few thousand years ago, a very well-spoken language of the Jewish people. But in the translation, you also have commentary. You have a little bit of commentary inflection. First of all, if anybody's ever translated something, you know that you can't translate word for word. It's really difficult. And if you do, you're probably going to miss out on the meaning of something if you translate it literally word for word. So you have to translate a concept. If you translate the concept, then you're sacrificing the accuracy and precision of the words. So you kind of try to strike a balance between, you know, being faithful to the original and also being faithful to the concept. Maimonides, by the way, famously wrote to his translator. You know, certain texts of Maimonides, he wrote originally in Arabic. Are you familiar with this? Speaking of which, Saturday night, join me for Cafe Chabad, Sharia, a Jewish primer on Islamic law, right? Speaking of Arabic, join us Saturday night for this incredible once, one-of-a-kind event. Okay, moving on.
Amazing how you snuck that in.
I totally snuck that in. I even went to the commercial voice. I gave a different tonality. All right, getting back to our discussion. So Maimonides writes a letter to his translator, and he says, you're going to face a choice again and again and again. Do I stick to the original or do I make it understandable in the new language, in the translated language? Do I make it readable and understandable to the student? And Maimonides says, when translating, always go to the concepts, not to the literal. In other words, make it understandable, sacrifice the original. But here's the point. Targum Yonatan it's a translation, but it also gives a little bit of commentary in it. So, Karen, please read text number. Wait, Ray, did you read?
No.
I'm sorry, Ray. I know I called on you, but I forgot that I interrupted. Okay, Ray, please read text 5, page 113. Take a look at the addition that Targum Yonatan gives. What does he add? Which phrase?
Take hold of it.
If you look in the Aramaic, what's the word? Ve'avad ba chazkata. Chazkata. What does that mean? Make a? Chazaka. What's chazaka? Take hold of it. But it's also a form of legal Jewish legal acquisition. In other words, what God is telling Abraham is not just stroll around the land, but by walking through the land, you're actually going to take hold of it. In Jewish law, famously, there has to be some sort of physical action that triggers any legal transaction. So you might have noticed this at a Jewish wedding, at a traditional Jewish wedding, yeah, right? So the chasen, the kala, the chatan or kala. So the chatan, when he takes upon himself the obligation of the ketubah, of the marriage document, so in many circles it's done traditionally where the chatan obviously consents to it, but verbal consent is one thing. But what he does is he actually takes some sort of item, like a yarmulke or a handkerchief or something, a gartel, lifts it up, and by acquiring that thing, physically lifting it up, he also acquires the obligations of the ketubah, which are spelled out in the document. The point is that in Jewish law, any change of status or anything that needs to happen in a legal sense has to be accompanied by some sort of physical action. So if God wants to transfer ownership of Israel to Abraham, so what happens? So he says to Abraham, you have to do something physical. So when it comes to land, by the way, one way to acquire property is by putting on a new lock or by, there's certain ways of like officially, formally in Jewish law acquiring land. But according to some opinions, one way is by walking it, walking the land, walking the property.
So he went all the way to the Euphrates?
You know, just casually went back and just a quick back and forth, you know, the usual, you know, Sunday afternoon type thing. So here's the point. According to this understanding, Abraham is actually acquiring, making a chazakah, acquiring the land of Israel through this, through traversing the land. Take a look at text 6, Karen, page 113. Here's Ramban Nachmanides, who specifies this.
Rise, walk in the land to its length and to its breadth. This can be interpreted as simply giving Jacob permission.
It's not, it's a mistake. There's Jacob written throughout. I don't know why they wrote Jacob. It's Abraham.
No, it's Abraham.
Oh. Yeah, this is absolutely incorrect. It's a typo. Somebody had Jacob on their head.
So anywhere I see Jacob, I should say Abraham.
Yeah, I mean, not throughout the entire Bible.
But in this guy. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so let's start again. Rise, walk in the land to its length and to its breadth. This can be interpreted as simply giving Abraham permission. You may walk wherever you wish, for I will be with you, and I have reserved it for you. If we interpret this as a mitzvah to actually walk the length and breadth of the land, it was to initiate a hazaka on the land, as I explained. Jacob was not commanded...
Abraham.
I'm sorry. Oh, gosh, I don't follow instructions. Abraham was not commanded to do so immediately, but he did eventually carry this out. At this time, he was in the east, and thereafter he traveled to the land of the Philistines, which was in the west, thereby fulfilling God's commandment in his life.
He didn't quickly dash over, but throughout his journeys in life, he went throughout the land.
The reason for this countrywide journey is stated further in the verse, for I have given it to you and your descendants. Namely, Abraham was instructed to initiate a chazaka on the gift of the land for his children after him. As our sages stated, it is an inheritance for us from our forefathers.
God is giving the land, gave the land to Abraham for his descendants, and he gave it to him, he promised it to him. And a promise by God, you would imagine, certainly is as good as God's word, which is pretty decent, pretty amazing, right? So it's done. God says, I have already given it to you. Abraham made a chazaka. He already took hold of the land, did a physical action to indicate ownership. Two generations later, his grandson Jacob, he needs to be promised again. Oh, by the way, this land is your land. What's going on here? And I know. There were great ideas mentioned. He's in a vulnerable position. He's leaving the land. He's afraid for his life. I get it. But still, let's ask the question. After all of this with Abraham, do we still need a reminder? Does Jacob still need a reminder from God that he's going to get the land? It seems a bit superfluous. Okay. So let's move on to, yeah. You're saying Ishmael and Esau, right? Now, if you dig into it specifically, so the Torah already said that ki be Yitzchak yikar lechazara, that it's only through Yitzchak that your seed, Abraham's seed, will be called. In other words, his legacy is going to flow through Isaac specifically and not Ishmael. By the way, Ishmael is the father of
the Arabs.
Join me Saturday night. Right, so the Torah already specifies, Ki bi Yitzchak yikarei lechazara, that through Isaac will your progeny be called. In other words, that's where it's going to flow. And when it came to Isaac, Yitzchak, he had two sons. And we read about that, right? Jacob buys the birthright. And he gets the blessing, so you think it'll flow through. Now, maybe it's confirmation for that, but again, we're going to stick with the question because we have a very unique, I think you'll find this incredibly unique, a very unique answer. By the way, it all goes back to while you were sleeping, which is our title for today's class. Okay, but let's now focus on another compelling detail of this story. Jacob is traveling. He's busting out of Canaan. He's going to Haran on his journeys. He lies down. He's tired. He rests. He falls asleep. And God appears to him and says, the ladder, and God says, don't worry, I got your back. You're going to get the land, all that good stuff. There's an interesting detail here. And let's go back. You don't have to open up the Chumash if you don't have it open. You can even go back to text 1, in our text, page 110. And I'll tell you what to focus on for a moment. Text 1 on page 110. Look what God says to Jacob. Look at what God says to Jacob. Second paragraph of text 1. And behold, God was standing over him, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. Listen to this. The land upon which you are lying, to you I will give it and to your seed. And I want to ask you a question. If you are a literalist, if you are very literal, look at the words. The land upon which you are lying, that is the land that I will give to you. How much land is being promised?
A plot. A cemetery plot.
Right? If you're being literal, and look in the Hebrew, it's the same thing. Ha'aretz, the land, asher atah, that you are shochev aleh, resting upon, the land that you're lying down upon, I am giving to you. Wait a second. Is that it? Because which land was he lying on? The whole land of Israel? I think not. Right? He's lying on one specific area of land. So is that all God's promising? What is going on here? The Talmud addresses this issue in text number 7. Does it make sense what I'm saying, what I'm pointing out? It's called a diuk. It's a I don't know how to translate diuk in English. It's a detail or whatever it is. We're looking at a nuance here and saying something does not make sense. Take a look at text 7, 115, Sindrine.
The land upon which you are lying, to you I will give it and to your seed. What is the greatness of this? Rabbi Yitzhak said, this teaches that the Holy One folded up the whole of the land of Israel and put it under our father Jacob, in order that he be easily conquered by his descendants. Like one who gets the rounding of 4 cubits, Rashi.
Okay, are you with me on this? What is the Talmud saying? The Talmud is saying the following, that God performed a miracle that night and he took the entire land of Israel and folded it up and placed it under Yaakov, under Jacob's sleeping body. So he wasn't just sleeping on a plot of land. He was sleeping on what? The entire land of Israel. So when God says, Ha'aretz, asher atah shochev aleh, the land upon which you are sleeping, I am giving to you, which land is being promised and given? Or being given? The entire land. Because God folded up the land. And I know what you're thinking. How awkward for the people with nice houses. It's like, you thought an earthquake was bad. Imagine like that scenario unfolding or folding. Tough crowd tonight. Anyway, I can't explain how it happened. And I have a hard time saying, trying to visualize how it happened. I don't know that I can actually give you a good way even to picture it or to imagine it. But this is what it says.
Is it like more conceptual?
I don't know. I'm saying I don't know. I don't know exactly. It seems like it's something of an actual thing, but we have to at this point. You know, I'll let your imagination, you know, figure it out as I can let mine try to figure out. But either way, the Talmud says that God folds up the land, right? Folds up the land, puts it underneath Yaakov like a mattress, and that's what he's sleeping on, the entire land of Israel. The big question is why? You know, well, because God said, the land that you're lying upon, I'm giving it to you, so it can't just be that one piece, so the whole land has to be under it. So let God say something else. Right? This land that you're leaving, I'm giving to you. Why the land that you're lying upon? That's, you understand my question? Why use a language? Okay, there's a klal, there's a general rule. And the general rule is that Hashem, God, does not do a miracle unnecessarily. In other words, God created the rules of nature because God wants things, by and large, to run by the rules of nature. And it's only in rare exceptions, the Jewish belief is, that God breaks the bounds of nature and performs a miracle on very rare occasions. Most of the time, and I know that that nature itself is a miracle, because who says that the sun rising each day and the fact that we have oxygen and whatever is not a miracle? And I would agree with that. Let's call that an incredible blessing and miracle from God, whatever. But if you're thinking of a miracle in the terms of that which is not natural, which is not ordinary, which is not consistent, and nature is that which is a miracle that happens consistently, which is a fine translation for me, well, bottom line is God likes, it appears, God likes consistency. And for God to do something that is not consistent with that consistency requires a good rationale for God to do it. Okay, so if God is breaking the bounds of nature and taking Israel and folding it up and putting it underneath Jacob, there has to be a reason for it, right? And it can't just be because God wanted to say this cool statement of the land that you're lying upon, I'm giving to you. And Jacob's like, what? Just this land? No, I folded everything under it. You got the whole thing. Congratulations. I mean, that can't, come on. That's just.
It makes more sense than stretching Jacob all the way.
Yeah, but then let him not say the land that you're lying upon. Right, I'm with you. Right, but why say lying upon? Just say the land that you're leaving, or the land of Canaan, or the land that I promised Abraham, it's still going to happen. There's other ways that you can frame it where you don't have to use that language and then fold it up and do this miracle. So therefore, the top, you and I have the answer already. We already read it inside of text 7. What's the answer? Why did God do this miracle? What's the answer? To make it more easily conquerable. In other words, God put the land under Jacob. And God says, just like you lie down on this land and you conquered it, right? So just like, not conquered it. That,
physical
hold. Yeah, so too, it's going to be easily conquered by his descendants, right? So God put the whole land of Israel under a father Jacob in order that it be easily conquered by his descendants. And Rashi explains there in the Talmud, in the parentheses, like one's immediate surroundings of 4 cubits. And that is a reference. That is a reference to a Jewish law, to a halacha known as a form of acquisition known as kinyan dalet amot, which means the acquisition of 4 cubits. So the rule is like this. If something is within 4 cubits of you, you can actually take legal acquisition of it if there are a few factors. Number one, you know about it. Number two, you have intention to acquire it, whatever. There's a few things that are involved, even though we said before they have to do something physical to acquire it, but being in proximity to that item is also considered to be somewhat of an acquisition. But you still have to have some sort of awareness and knowledge of it. You can't be standing near something and not be aware of it or not want it. Anyway, those laws are very interesting. The point is, just like a person acquires something that's in their vicinity, in their 4 cubits. 4 cubits is about 6 to 8 feet. So too, what the Talmud is saying, Yaakov acquired the land that was lying underneath him. So he acquired, and it's allowing that his descendants should acquire the land of Israel when they ultimately come in the times of Joshua, after Moses passes away, after the Exodus, after the 40 years of wandering, when the Jewish people come in, it should be easier for them to conquer by virtue of Jacob now resting on the land. So that's why God folds it up and puts it under him, so it's in his hand, so to speak. It's in his four cubits, and it's more easily conquered by his descendants. Make sense? Sort of? Yes? Right. under your back? Okay. You're saying practically it wasn't? A lot of it was, though. Think about Jericho. Right? Walls came down by themselves. Now, not everything was as easy. And as you know, with the stories of Tanakh, there's a lot of drama that goes down and a lot of wars that are fought and hundreds of years of fighting that happened subsequently in, you know, this, that, and the other, even times of King David, even to this day, right? So there's been a lot of strife. And yet, on some level, his lying down on the land made it that much smoother. Can you imagine what it would look like had he not lied down on the land, or had God not made that miracle? Okay, so now, here's what we need to notice. Okay, Rashi comments on this verse in our Torah portion, the verse that talks about Jacob lying down on the ground, and God saying, the land upon which you are lying, I am giving to you. So here's Rashi's comment, text 8. Now, I need to point out what we're doing here. Text 7 was from the Talmud. The Talmud tells us that God folded it in order that it should be easily conquered by his descendants. Okay, text 8 is Rashi's commentary on our verse in the Torah, and Rashi channels, what's the right word that I'm looking for? Not channels, Rashi, I don't know. Rashi channels the Talmud's explanation and puts it into his commentary. Take a look at text number 8, but pay attention to some distinctions. Steve.
The Holy One, blessed be He, folded the entire land of Israel under Him. He hinted to Him that it would be as easily conquered by His children.
Is Rashi saying the same thing in his commentary on the Bible as the Talmud says?
He hinted to it?
Tell me where Rashi differs. Remember, Rashi's commentary is derived from the classical teachings, by and large, from the classical teachings of our sages. The Talmud was authored in and around the years 400, 500, 600. Rashi lives around the 1000s or 1000s, whatever. So Rashi lives a good 4 or 5 centuries after the Talmud. Rashi was an expert in Talmud. In fact, he wrote a commentary on the Talmud, which we saw in the parentheses in text 7. Rashi studied the Midrash, studied the Talmud, obviously studied Chumash, the Torah, and he wrote a commentary pulling from existing classic sources. Mm-hmm. Rashi is clearly operating from, is clearly expressing what the Talmud in text 7 is saying in his own words, but there are some nuances. What are the distinctions between Rashi and the Talmud?
It's one word.
Well, I think that he is saying, Rashi's saying, it is extremely easy for Hashem.
Okay.
The entire land of Israel under Yahweh.
It's one
and
word.
As easy as that is, it will be that easy for us to conquer them.
Okay, and the Talmud is saying?
And the Talmud is saying,
it's I'm one word.
Chazan, what do you have?
But it's yeah. easily conquered.
Yeah, it's the word Ramazlo.
Ramazlo, good. So we have this addition in Rashi. Rashi says, the Talmud says that God folded up the land, put it under Jacob, in order that it be easily conquered. And Rashi says, he hinted to him that it would be as easily conquered. And you might think, well, it's no big deal. Who cares? No big deal. But I'll tell you it is a big deal. Because every word in Rashi is accounted for and is precise. If Rashi decides to modify, to add a word that the Talmud doesn't have, there's got to be a good reason for it. Another nuance that we might notice, yeah?
One is descendants and one is children, which is...
it's the same word.
No, it's... that's a translation. I don't know why they did that.
Okay.
Especially when at least the exercise that I'm doing is comparing and contrasting, and the English, it just throws us off for no reason. I don't know. It's Levanav, which sons or children or descendants, it's all the same. But anyway, that's really the clearest textual distinction. Rashi adds the word Ramaz, that God is hinting to Jacob that it's going to be easily conquered, that the land will be easily conquered by his children, whereas the Talmud says that it should be, that it be easily conquered, not that God was hinting to him anything. So that's one point. There's another point, and this is a little bit more, this is not really in the text itself, as you'll see what I mean in a second, but nonetheless, it's a nuance that we can point out. Remember Rashi's commentary on the Talmud was in the parentheses? Rashi said that his descendants would easily conquer the land like one's immediate surroundings of 4 cubits. Like the 4 cubits that a person has around him or her. In Rashi's commentary, and that's Rashi's addition to the Talmud, but in Rashi's commentary in the Bible, he doesn't include that addition. You would imagine if Rashi felt it was so important to add it to the Talmud, why didn't he interject that piece of clarification in his biblical commentary as well? If he's writing a Talmudic commentary and a biblical commentary and he adds one in one, why doesn't he add those few words in the other? And if you want to say, well, he doesn't want to add words to the original, well, he already added a word, and that was the first point that I mentioned. He added the word Ramaz. I know I'm asking very nuanced questions, and it's a very analytical approach we're taking to Rashi, but I need to point out something that I think is compelling. In 1964, shortly after the Rebbe's mother passed away, the Rebbe would spend most every Shabbat a few hours discussing Rashi. Rashi is known to be the simplest commentary. There are commentaries that deal in the level of remez, hints and allusions. There's midrashic commentaries on Torah. There is sod, there are mystical, Kabbalistic interpretations of Torah. Rashi famously, and we've discussed this countless times in this session, these Wednesday night sessions, Rashi's intention is to explain pshat, the simple meaning of the verse. And therefore, on the level of pshat, sometimes a person might overlook Rashi and say, yeah, Rashi's good for when you first start learning Chumash, when you first start learning Torah, and you want to know what happens in the story and what the words mean, then you study Rashi. But once you've gone through it once, Then you become more sophisticated and you introduce other commentaries into the mix. Starting in 1964 and spanning 25 years, the Rebbe spent Shabbat after Shabbat a total of over 800 talks on Rashi. 800 plus talks devoted to Rashi. The Rebbe would often ask a dozen or more questions on a single line of Rashi's commentary. In fact, from the Rebbe's analysis of Rashi, there's been multiple books published called Klalei Rashi, the rules of Rashi derived from how the Rebbe understands Rashi. The Rebbe took Rashi and exposed the brilliance of Rashi's commentary, not only in Pshat, not only in the simple understanding, but on every level. The Rebbe would explain how Rashi is alluding, hinting to the halachic, the legal ramifications of whatever it is that we're talking about, and how he alludes to the mystical dimension of it. In nuanced words of Rashi, Rashi is hinting to these incredible other ideas, but you have to know how to learn Rashi. The Rebbe asks these questions that I'm asking. One of the rules, one of the klalim, one of the general principles that the Rebbe establishes when analyzing Rashi's commentary is that if Rashi deviates, if Rashi is using a source in the Midrash or in the Talmud to write a commentary on a biblical verse, if he's citing that, then he should cite it word for word. If he doesn't, it's intentional. And therefore, to ask why does Rashi add a word is a legitimate question. Because Rashi doesn't play around. If Rashi adds a word that God was hinting to Jacob, why hinting? The Talmud doesn't say hinting. There's no mention of hinting in the Talmud. Where's Rashi getting it from? Not only where's he getting it from, what does it add? What's missing that you need the word hinting to explain? What's going on here? You're saying, why doesn't God speak directly? What? God, what's with this hinting? Good. So that's a conceptual question, since when does God hint? But on a very basic level, the question of Rashi is, why is Rashi adding words and changing some element of the understanding of what's going on? Rashi is basing this off of the source in the Talmud. Why is he deviating from the source? There must be a compelling reason for Rashi to do so. Okay. So we need to understand this. Oh, and by the way, if you look at text 7 and text 8, the Talmud says that God folded up the land of Israel and put it under Jacob in order that it be easily conquered by his descendants, which means that putting it under him actually made it easier for them to conquer. And Rashi says that God did it, hinting to him that it would be easily conquered by his children, which means that nothing happened at that time. It wasn't empowering it. It's hinting that it would be easy. The Talmud says he made it. That action made it easier. And Rashi says it's hinting that it would ultimately be easier. Two different things. It's one word, but it changes the meaning. According to the Talmud, the act of folding it under Jacob makes the subsequent conquering easier. And according to Rashi, on the verse itself, Rashi says, this is a hint that later on it would be easier. It's a hint, but not that it's making it easier. Okay, so these are the questions that we have on Rashi. Why is Rashi deviating from the original? So here we go. And you need to, one more thing about the Rebbe's talks on Rashi. They're known as Rashi Sichot. The Rebbe would ask a dozen questions, or sometimes four, or six, or eight, or an odd number also. And in the process, would totally, and I've mentioned this before, deconstruct Rashi. When I say deconstruct, the whole thing now doesn't make sense. What's Rashi doing? The Rashi, for example, in this case, there's a Talmud. There's a Talmudic precedent. The Talmud is authoritative. Rashi's writing a commentary, but he's basing it off the Talmud. And Rashi is deviating from what the Talmud says. Rashi's adding words and changing the meaning. The Talmud never said that God is hinting to Jacob that it would be easier. The Talmud says that by folding it under Jacob, God is making it easier, not hinting. So where's Rashi coming up with this? What's he doing? Where is he coming up with it? And why is he coming up with anything in the first place? What's wrong with the Talmud? Now, there's no rule that says that Rashi can't come up with his own ideas. But if he's coming up with his own ideas that are slight variations off of what the Talmud clearly says, there better be a good reason for that. Otherwise, we can ask the question. We ought to ask the question, what is Rashi thinking? What is he doing? Make sense? So it all hinges on our opening question. What's our opening question? What's the first question we asked? Why promise again? Give me a hint. Hold on while I fold up this. the opening question, exactly. The opening question was, Bechlal, in general, why is God promising Abraham? Sorry. Why is God promising Jacob the land of Israel if God had already promised Abraham and given it to Abraham and Abraham already walked it and acquired it on some level? Why are we doing this again? And so the Rebbe points out that there are two modalities of conquering. There's the conquering that requires effort, symbolized by walking the land, right? It's a schlep. What did the Ramban say? That it took him a lifetime to walk the whole land. He walked a little bit then. You know, at that point in time, he walked a little bit later, and throughout his life, he had walked the whole thing. To walk the land requires effort. So there's two ways to conquer. You can walk the land. What does that mean?
Effort.
Good, you're listening. Right, you're putting in effort. It wasn't a trick. Everyone's like, trick question. No. Either you're putting in effort. What's the second form of, that's Abraham. What's the second form of conquering the land? Jacob's conquering. How did he conquer it? Through?
Lying down and sleeping.
And what's that?
Sleep is important.
Sleep is important. We're not going to knock sleep. But what is that? If Abraham's walking the land is effort, what's Jacob sleeping? No effort. Exactly. Thank you. You're right on point tonight.
Jacob's always in here.
You should know. I like you sitting
Jacob
here.
Jacob is always successful when he's lying.
Oh, ooh. Ooh, wow. Digging up old grievances. Oof. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Lying. That was good. That was very good. Okay, so hold on. There's two ways to conquer. You can conquer by walking. In other words, through effort. You can also conquer by lying down, and that's no effort. So let's understand this. Abraham is told, you are going to conquer. You're going to set the stage for... The Ramban says, famously, Nachmanides in another place, Ma'isa avot siman labanim, that the actions of our forefathers are a sign to the children. And it's not just that what our ancestors did kind of foretells what's going to happen to the children, but it blazes the path. You know, there's a movement in the world. There's a movement amongst, you know, thinkers and whatever, educators, about the power of storytelling. There's a local professor that's written up, that's written extensively about this, Professor Marshall Duke, and there's a thing, it's about telling your family's story. And when parents tell their children the family story, it actually builds resilience in the child. Because when the child encounters difficulty, the child says, oh, wait a second, my bubby, my Zaidi, my great-great whatever it is, also went through something difficult, and they survived. Maybe they were facing difficulties in another country, and then they emigrated to the United States, and whatever it is, but they survived, they conquered, whatever it is, and now look, they were successful, I can do it too. Telling the stories helps of the parents and grandparents, helps the children, Ma'isa Avot, Siman Labanim, the actions, the journeys of our ancestors help the children, help us. And so Abraham helps us. When you need to fight and you need to conquer and you need to walk 1,000 miles, Abraham did it. And you say to yourself, how can I do it? How can I battle? How can I walk that walk and fight that fight? Abraham did it. So what did Jacob do? Jacob conquered the land while sleeping. He acquired the land in his own way. Abraham acquired it by walking it. How does Jacob acquire it? By sleeping. He slept, as the story tells us. He didn't even know. He woke up and said, "Oh, I had no idea." Right? Did you read that inside? Yeah, I'll read it again, just because, you know, it's been a while. So God says to Jacob, "I'm giving you this land," etc. And then Jacob says, can't turn the page. Yep. Yaakov woke up from his sleep and said, "God is truly in this place, and I didn't realize. Otherwise, I wouldn't have slept here." In other words, Jacob conquers the land in his own way. How? By not even realizing it. Understand how polar opposite these two forms of conquering are. One is conquering through intention and through effort and through struggle and through toil and through schlepping and through fighting and through all that. And the other one is accomplishing something, is conquering not only without effort, but even without being consciously aware of it.
Well, if you go on in the text too, which, you know, I mean, he, even after he has that dream, then he makes, you know, kind of a deal with God, saying, so not only was he unaware of it, but he also still did not have, this developed faith in God, to trust that God would show him the way, would show him his path.
Right, if you do this, then I'll do that, and then we'll make you a monument. It's going to be a whole thing.
So it's all, you know, everything about this whole story is one of trepidation and doubt and lack of awareness and complacency.
We're gonna frame the idea of him sleeping and being unaware of it actually as a positive, as an effortless type of conquering something.
Okay.
The way it's so, we'll have to leave off that second half of Jacob's statement subsequently to God. We'll leave that for another time. Oh, we're fresh out of time here tonight. Sorry, folks. We'll have to deal with that next time. Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, listen, that's actually the subject of a lot of commentaries. Why is Jacob still negotiating? And does it indicate lack of faith? Some people say it was a little bit of that, and there was a little bit of punishment that happened. Whatever. That's a big topic. But I want to stick with the way the Rebbe explains this in volume 20 of Likutei Sichot of the Rebbe's talks, where the Rebbe asked the questions on Rashi, and the way the Rebbe ends up explaining this, again, based on the opening question that we had, is why is God promising this again to Jacob? Because there are two different ways in which the land can be conquered. Abraham is promised that if it requires a fight, they'll be able to win the fight. They'll be able to walk the walk, and they'll be able to get it conquered and to get it to happen. And Jacob, Yaakov, is another type of conquering altogether. And Jacob's conquering of the land happens effortlessly while he's sleeping. I want to give you an example in our own personal lives, because that's ultimately what this is about. These stories are stories, but for us, it's what does it mean for us today? There are two ways that you and I can conquer something that needs to be conquered. When I say conquer, I mean, you know, turning the land of Canaan, the land of the seven nations, into the land of Israel, turning it into the Holy Land, turning land, physical earthly land, into something that has the adjective holy, turning materialism into spirituality, turning our inner landscape, as Kabbalah teaches, our landscape of seven nations, seven midot, chesed, gevurah, teferet, netzach, hod, yesod, malchut, for those familiar with the seven spheres, the seven emotional characteristics that sometimes can be very ugly and very other, outside of the godly realm, how to transform them into holy spaces. So to conquer the land of the seven nations, to conquer our inclination oftentimes requires effort. We have to fight against what we naturally desire. We have to fight against, instinct and self-preservation, whatever it is. We have to fight against our natural reaction to do something that is higher, to do something that is holy, to do something that's right. It's not always easy to do what's right. It's often so much easier to not do what's right. And to do what's right requires sometimes a superhuman effort. But each of us has areas in our lives in which doing the right thing comes effortlessly. right? Certain things that we're not even tempted about to go there. Certain things, that's in the negative. Certain positive mitzvot that we love doing, it comes effortlessly. Certain things are difficult and requires us to steel ourselves, S-T-E-E-L, right? Steel ourselves and force ourselves and do it and push back. And sometimes we get it right and sometimes we get it not so right. But other areas are effortless. We do it and we love to do it. Or we don't do it and we would never want to do it. Each of us has a line where it's, in the Yiddish we would say it's abgefragt. What's abgefragt? It means it's not even a question. We would never even entertain such a notion. Other areas, we would definitely entertain it. And sometimes we do it, but we have to distance ourselves from it. We have to fight. But other areas are completely out of the question. I'll give you an example. And this is a personal example, an example that I've given before. But it's just to bring out a point. You know, if my kids ask me, and I have, you know, Shalom and Mendel, you might have noticed them here, which you may hear them also in the background a little bit. Don't pull out the, right? It's like, I know everyone's, we're on Facebook, so we have to keep this on the old down low for all of our locals. The good news is you're all safe on Facebook, we think. Anyway, so if my kids are more likely to ask me, okay, I'm trying to figure the best way to phrase this. My children might ask me at dinner time, oh, can we have, or right before dinner time, can we have, or right after dinner, can we have a candy or a cookie, whatever it is, you know, some sort of thing. And I'll tell them no. And they're like, no, we really want. It's like, no, okay, fine. Right? But when we're eating, let's say, a fleishik meal, a meat meal, and they'll ask about, ice cream, okay, fine, or milk, or cheese, it's no. And they usually sense that the conversation is closed. They know that it's closed, right? But I could say no for the candy and no for the dairy. I can say the same word no, but one leads to negotiations. And the other one, it stops immediately. Why? Because one is negotiable. Because sometimes they will, you know, sometimes, okay, fine, whatever. It's there, we don't have that. It's not an absolute red line. But the other one is an absolute red line. It's like, what, you had meat, you're not going to have dairy. It's 6 hours, man. Come to me 3 a.m., we'll discuss this. Or not 3 a.m., come to me at midnight or 1 a.m., We'll discuss it then. Good luck getting me. It ain't happening. I'm kidding. So here's the point. There are certain areas in which we don't stand so strongly. And this is not an indictment. Because who's perfect? There's no, King Solomon writes, there's no perfect individual human being on earth who only does good and doesn't have any shortcomings. We all have shortcomings. So there are areas in which our conviction is theoretically strong, but practically, it's up for negotiation. And sometimes we're stronger and sometimes we're less strong. Sometimes we win, sometimes we lose in the battle of, you know, good versus evil, whatever it is, or right versus wrong. And it's a battle, and every time it's a battle. It's a battle because we don't have that conviction, that absolute conviction. So since there's an opening, that leads to a battle. It's like my kids know that sometimes when they've pushed, I've relented on the candy front, so then they're going to push. And this is fun. It is what it is. It's not like a big deal. I'm just saying. But then it becomes not a battle, but then this comes back up again and again and again. But certain things, when we have that inner conviction, it's not negotiable. It's not going to happen. It just shuts down the conversation immediately. And within ourselves, there are certain things in which our evil inclination, our Yetzer Hara, doesn't even bother anymore. Because it knows that it's a non-negotiable. It knows that when it dangles that in front of us, like, no, come on, it's not happening. or when it tries to dissuade us from doing something positive, we every single time we say, of course I'm going to do it. You can't convince me out of it. Of course I'm going to do it. So there's certain areas in life in which we are not so headstrong, in which we don't have as much conviction, and that lends itself to a battle. And that requires walk in the land. And other times, we have that conviction. And it's easy. We can do it in our sleep. We can conquer that in our sleep. It's not even an issue. This is the gift that God gave to Jacob. After God gave Abraham the land through conquering, through walking the land, God gave Jacob the land through sleeping on the land. And God tells Jacob and he tells us that in life, when you need to conquer something, there's two ways. You can be not so sure and not so strong and fight it every single time, or you can try to get to a place where that becomes your absolute conviction, non-negotiable. And then it becomes easy. Halavai, if only all of life's challenges we could have that conviction, it's probably not going to happen. But perhaps, as a result of this class, we can look at one area of our lives and say, how can I make that one area, move it into the category of things that are non-negotiable, things that are absolute, things that I am not even, no longer open for negotiation or consideration, things that I just know either I won't or I absolutely will without a question, without a doubt. This is what happens while we're sleeping. This is conquering something in our sleep. This is easy breezy. I don't know. I'm sure there's another phrase that rhymes with that. Whatever. This is the easy way to conquer. This is not easy, but it's something that we can strive for. And so Rashi says that what did God do? God didn't make it easy for Jacob, and God didn't make it easy for his descendants, because ultimately it was a battle. It was a battle to conquer the land of Israel. But God hinted that at some point in time, you and I can choose to make something so resolute by us that it's not going to be difficult. And when Mashiach comes, it's going to be a different type of conquering the land of Israel. Of course, it's very difficult now, and we live in Galut, we live in exile, and there's a lot of challenges that we all have, physically, but most importantly, spiritually. The bottom line is, Mashiach is an era where everything is clear, where there's clarity, and there's no fight, there's no inner battle anymore. This is the paradigm, this is the reality that God opened up for Jacob. God opened up a vision. Jacob didn't even know that he was conquering the land on a certain level, right? And he did. There are certain things that in life that we do positive that come easy. And someone says, wow, I can't believe you did it. And you're like, that's not a big deal. I always do that. Or I can't believe you didn't do it. Why would I ever do that? Of course not. That goal is to move one more thing over to that category. And then when that's done, find one more. Thank you for joining me tonight for Torah Studies. Hope this resonated for you. Keep the applause coming. Joking. Thank you.